This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Today we talk with unannounced candidate for governor, Brian Kelly, about his proposal for a part-time legislature.
So what you have is a system that requires that you get in, do the important work, and go back home.
There's a little tussle over turning Belle Isle in Detroit into a raceway every summer.
The debate is really intensifying between what I call park-goers and gearheads.
We have a Cheers cocktail. This time, Tammy Coxon comes up with her own concoction.
As I drank it, I thought this could really work with this Michigan Amaro, and I came back and I experimented.
And what was the top hit on Billboard charts 50 years ago today? Plus, a science advisor to the EPA administrator reacts to the decision to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accord. But first, here's a news update. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly said he'd make a big announcement at the Mackinac Policy Conference. It was widely expected he would announce his candidacy for governor. That's not what he did. Instead, he released a 10-point plan he calls Clean Michigan's Government. Lieutenant Governor Kelly joins us now. Some of what you're calling for is about transparency in the legislature, making sure legislators and the public get a chance to read bills before they're voted on, expanding the Freedom of Information Act and making sure it's applied equally to the executive branch and the legislative branch, require legislators to disclose their financial interests so that people are aware of any conflicts of interest, all steps toward more open government. I think a lot of people would applaud that, maybe not some of the legislators. What's more controversial is your suggestion to make the legislature part-time, limiting its work to 3 months and cutting legislators' pay. Why are you proposing that?
Well, that would put Michigan into the mainstream. 41 other states across the country operate on a part-time system, and by doing so, they make the system more efficient. They get rid of the posturing and the procrastination and pushing things off to lame duck sessions. You know, the part-time legislature system, there is no lame duck. And so what you have is a system that requires that you get in, do the important work, and go back home. And then you also just get fewer laws proposed. I mean, there are thousands of laws that are proposed every legislative session. And that's not an exaggeration, literally thousands of laws that are proposed. And this year-round lawmaking process is something that is very, very unusual around the country. And it doesn't add value for our taxpayers. Just get in, get the work done, go back home.
As you might recall, in 2014, a similar proposal was discussed. I covered that issue at the time. And I talked to Carl Kurtz. He's with the National Conference of State Legislatures. He's studied the difference between part-time legislatures and full-time legislatures, and he had a couple of concerns. The first one was whether a part-time legislator can effectively balance the power of a very large executive branch and being a watchdog over the many agencies and offices. And secondly, limiting legislators to part-time and low pay makes working on behalf of the people in their district difficult. I mean, you've got Senate members representing about 250,000 people. They have a lot of requests for help. What are your thoughts about those concerns?
Well, right now, when you have this full-time system, I think it's the most restrictive on service because you require that people that want to serve end up completely abandoning whatever career track in life that they have back home in the real world for this service for a finite period of time. And there aren't very many people that can do that, certainly not people that are raising families. And that's so what you're limited to are people that essentially want to make a career out of politics. And I just don't think that's the best way to assemble a body to represent the people, is to have people that are just looking to make a career out of it. This should be the sort of a true citizens legislature. And by making it such that the main source of income is not the political system itself, I think that we'll get better laws that way.
Wouldn't you say, though, a term-limited part-time legislator who gets paid a lot less means the average person who wants to serve in the public office, serve in the legislature, won't be able to do that? I mean, there's not enough money. That likely means only the wealthy or people basically given a job by a corporation or a special interest to supplement the low pay would run and presumably, you know, push policy that they want. How is that good for Michigan and its citizens?
Sometimes it's difficult to imagine change because people get used to how things are in their particular area. But if you look around the country, that is not the way that it is. Most, in fact, at 31,000, which is about what I'm proposing for this 90-day session that legislators would do, that's still actually pretty good pay compared to what the rest of the nation does, including you know, we've got some big states that that operate with part-time systems. So the idea that people in different types of jobs and careers, small business owners, could be tourism industry, could be agriculture, could be retired people, also could be those that just have an employer that's willing to work with them in terms of establishing the kind of schedule that allows them to serve. All of these things are possible. All I know is that there are more people that could serve in a part-time system than that could ever serve and keep their life going back in the real world when you're required to do a full-time year-round. No employer can work with full-time year-round away, but I believe that there are many, many more people that will have service in their grasp when you don't require them to essentially abandon whatever career track that they have in the real world in order to serve. That's the mainstream. That's what happens in most places around the country.
A researcher at Harvard University found states with part-time legislatures spent less time crafting policy and were more likely to enact model legislation proposed by a special interest group, particularly the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. What would prevent state government from becoming more controlled by lobbyists and special interests?
Well, I think that this actually takes the power out of the hands of lobbyists and special interests, because think about this. When lobbyists and special interests want to affect people that are making laws, right now we concentrate them year-round in one place. It's like shooting fish in a barrel. If the lobbyists and special interests have to go to the district of the person and lobby them in the context of their home, I think that they're not going to lose sight of the interests of the people that they represent, because they're going to live most of their lives in and around and among the people that they represent. So from a lobbying standpoint, lobbying legislators becomes way, way harder with a part-time system than it is with a full-time system.
You've not announced as a candidate for governor, as I mentioned earlier, but as Zach Gorchel at Gongwer wrote in a recent blog, you're running a de facto campaign. I mean, it would be really convenient if a new governor found the legislature was a little weaker. Gorchel writes political insiders are concerned about that. So what's your response to those concerns?
It doesn't weaken the legislature. I mean, if that was the case, how does this exist in 41 other states around the country?
Well, those states are most of those states are smaller states. This is a larger, more complex state than many of those 41.
How about Florida and how about Texas? Those are bigger than Michigan. So, I mean, and how about New Jersey is bigger than Michigan, too? I mean, so there's a lot of angst about making change, and the status quo and people that live off the status quo will always be afraid of change, and they will just defend the status quo. But we are doing it the unusual way. And so when it comes to balance of powers, the legislature makes laws about 90 days a year. Under my proposal, they make laws about 90 days a year. The only difference is I'm proposing that they do it in the condensed session as opposed to stretching that 90 days over the entire year. It doesn't change the balance of powers at all, and I think it's just really a hollow argument.
Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly's 10-point plan can be found on the website, cleanmigovt.org. Lieutenant Governor, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks so much.
It's almost the weekend. Time for a drink.
Cheers.
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 Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon of Tammy's Tastings, and you've got a drink of your own invention this time.
That's right. So you remember a few weeks ago we talked about a sweet vermouth from Bregman Brothers Winery up in the Leelanau Peninsula.
Right, yeah.
Well, they also make an Amaro. So Amaro are these bittersweet Italian liqueurs. Typically they come from Italy, but now we're starting to see American producers make Amaros as well, just like they're starting to make sweet vermouths.
Well, the lineup you had included that, and it kind of looked like an international gathering. You brought out stuff I've never seen before.
Well, that's right. So this drink I called the Stopover, and that's because I actually got inspired to create it when I happened to be in Iceland recently. And Iceland, because the airlines allow you to take a free stopover there, it's become something of a meeting grounds for people from all over the world. And this cocktail is, as you noted, a meeting ground for ingredients from all over the world.
Besides the Amaro from Bregman Brothers, what else do we have?
Well, we have another Amaro from Italy. This is called Amaro Montenegro. It's one of my absolute favorite Amaros. Nice sort of mild bitterness, some floral flavors, some nice spice notes. Just a really friendly and approachable Amaro. And then to go with that, we have an unusual ingredient from the Czech Republic. So they wouldn't call this an Amaro, but it's kind of in the same category. It's herbal, it's spicy, it's called Bekarovka. It has a little bit of a cinnamon note to it. One of the things that's important in the structure of this cocktail is that, unlike most Amaros, which are bottled at a relatively low proof, this is 38% ABV. So it's filling in here for a base spirit like gin or rum or something like that, but bringing a lot of flavor with it.
This sounds like it might be really sweet.
It is definitely a little sweet, but we've stirred it really well. I also garnished it with an orange twist, so that's going to bring some orange oil, which is going to brighten up those flavors. But you might find that you would like this better as an after-dinner drink.
So how do you make this?
So we start with 1.5 ounces of the Bekarovka, and then 3/4 ounce each of the Amaro Montenegro and the Amaro from Bregman Brothers, and then stir those with some ice, strain them onto fresh ice in an old-fashioned glass, and garnish with that orange peel.
Well, let me try the stopover. Oh, I love the aroma. Oh, it's not as sweet as I thought it might be. That bitterness from the different liqueurs makes it a lot more complicated than I expected it to be.
It's definitely a really complex drink. This isn't going to be something that everybody's going to love. It's not going to be an easy drinking patio drink for summer, but it is a great exploration of some complex ingredients from around the world, including one right here from Michigan.
The name Stopover is inspired by Iceland. What was the drink inspired by?
So I met a bartender there, and I asked him to make me a drink, and he made me something along these lines using an ingredient from London that we can't get here. But as I drank it, I thought this could really work with this Michigan Amaro, and I came back and I experimented. The bartender said that he was really thinking about this drink as being a variant on the classic cocktail, the Negroni. And so this is actually really nice timing to make this drink, because every year there's an event called Negroni Week, and that starts on Monday, June 5th this year.
And that's basically it for all kinds of charities. Each bar decides which one. Remind us what the Negroni is made of.
So the Negroni is a classic cocktail with gin, sweet vermouth, and Campari. So this cocktail has none of the same ingredients, but it sort of has a similar philosophy to it. And that's how he got his inspiration. And next week during Negroni Week, all sorts of bars all over Michigan will be making up their own Negronis, some classics, some crazy variations like this one. Good opportunity to explore that drink and benefit some charities.
Sounds like fun.
Cheers.
Still to come, we'll talk about President Trump's decision to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The U.S. Senate is considering the American Health Care Act. That's the Republican plan to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare. To help us better understand what might change, we're turning to one of the industries at the center of those changes, health care insurance. Terry Klein is president and CEO of Health Alliance Plan. That's a subsidiary of the Henry Ford Health System. Since the U.S. House of Representatives passed the American Health Care Act, we got a review of the impact of that act from the Congressional Budget Office. What's your take on the differences between the Republican plan and Obamacare?
So there's several differences in the American Health Care Act from the Affordable Care Act. And the main one really looks at taking a lot of the responsibility for the oversight and regulation of health care back to the states. It takes a lot of particularly the funding for the Medicaid programs and puts it back at the state level in capitated payments. So that's the primary difference.
Some people would rather see the flaws in Obamacare fixed rather than the whole plan scrapped. What would you change to make Obamacare work?
Well, there's several things about the Affordable Care Act that have not worked very well. And so there may be three things that I'd really look at changing. The first is I would put a lot more of the regulatory oversight for health insurance back at the state level, where people are much closer to the subscribers and the members and the patients. And then secondly, I'd look at rate band changes. So today there's a 3-to-1 rating band system, and I would improve that to either 5-to-1 or 7-to-1, which would make the costs on the for the younger people much lower. It would increase.
Okay, you've got to explain that whole concept to us, because I'm not sure that any of us, certainly I don't know what rate bands are. So you're talking about age groups and what their
groups. Basically, I'm saying that today we have three age groups, and I would say that it would be better to have 5 or 7 age bands for rating purposes, because that would allow younger people to have much lower rates, and more young people would come into an insurance system, which would be good for everybody.
And your third point?
My third point is that I think that we need to really look at making sure that we fund the things that we actually say that we're going to fund, like cost-sharing subsidies. and the different elements of the Obamacare plan that have not always gotten the funding they're supposed to.
I understand you feel the healthcare industry should be able to incentivize healthy behaviors and penalize unhealthy behaviors. How would that work?
So you can do it through some sort of rating mechanism, or you can do it through premium subsidies. You can do it through additional premium costs for behaviors like smoking or obesity. So you're really incentivizing people to become a little healthier, to control their own health insurance premium costs, and also then their overall total costs.
You're a Michigan native, but you've worked in the healthcare insurance industry for a long time in a lot of different parts of the nation. How does Michigan compare when it comes to affordability and access to healthcare?
So I think on the affordability scale, Michigan is at the top end. Cost of care is very high in Michigan compared to other places in the country.
And how about access to it?
I think we have a number of really high-quality providers in the state. So I think access to care on at least the physical health side of the equation is really good. On the behavioral health side, we have some really significant access problems in the state of Michigan.
I was going to say the rural areas, there are some counties that don't have gynecologists, obstetricians. I mean, there are some places that don't have great access, but you're saying comparatively we're not that bad.
I think in many parts of the country there are access issues to either specialty care or primary care. So there are many states where there are access issues that are significant. In Michigan, there are certainly areas in rural counties where there are access issues to subspecialty care. But in general, I think access is relatively good in Michigan.
One constant, regardless of what Congress does, is trying to figure out a health insurance plan that's right for you. It's very confusing for a lot of people. You're in favor of educating consumers so they might make the right choice, or they can make the right choice. You're an insurance company. Obviously, you have something at stake here. So who do you think should be the neutral party or the honest broker in educating those consumers?
Well, I think there can be lots of different routes for educating consumers. I mean, certainly could start even in the secondary school system, educating people about health and how to stay healthy and how to look for, you know, what insurance covers, what it doesn't cover. So I think you could start education very young and you can continue it through multiple channels. I think that there are many, many ways on a public service basis that you can get that kind of education out to consumers. It's a continual process, I think, because as people go through their lives, they have different points of contact with the healthcare delivery system and they need different kinds of things. But educating people about how their benefits work and how healthcare works is really important to helping people stay healthy. So I think even things like immunization schedules, helping people understand what kind of immunizations they should get for their kids and what kind of immunizations they could get for themselves as they go through adulthood and into early senior life.
You're at the Mackinac Policy Conference. There are lots of business people and politicians there. What are people asking you regarding the future of healthcare insurance?
So I clearly have had a lot of questions about the Affordable Care Act and what things might need to be changed about it to make it sustainable. There's also, I think, a lot of interest in technology at this conference and how we can apply technology to all facets of our business lives, including healthcare.
That's Terry Klein. She's the president and CEO of the Health Alliance Plan. Thanks very much for taking a break from the conference and talking to us.
Thank you very much.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Joining me now is Joe Arvai. He's the professor of sustainable enterprise at the University of Michigan and one of the people who advises the EPA on some of its science. We're going to talk about President Trump's decision to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord. What's your first reaction to that?
My first reaction is it doesn't make much sense on a lot of different levels. It's bewildering because it goes against public opinion. It's bewildering because it goes against economic principles. I'm left quite shocked today.
But this was a campaign promise, and his base, the conservative base that he depends on and is still campaigning for, it appears to me, wanted this.
Yeah, I would agree. I think we can dig a little deeper than that, though. If you look at trends in each of the 50 states, a majority of adults of voting age, registered voters, believe that climate change is happening. They're concerned about the risks. They believe that greenhouse gases should be regulated as pollutants. They believe that energy producers should be required to cut back on their greenhouse gas emissions. If you look at Trump voters specifically, it's a near majority of Trump voters who believe those very same things in each of of the 50 states. So even if he's looking to his base, I think he's misguided. He's a good 3.5 years from re-election if nothing strange happens between now and then. So the idea that he's going to be locking up a bunch of voters with this doesn't make sense to me either.
So he keeps saying that this was bad for business. This caused plants. We were spending hundreds of billions and giving it to other nations. He says it disadvantaged the U.S. to the exclusive benefit of other countries. And I keep hearing businesses say they want stability. They're staying the course on reducing emissions. They see the long-term trend now is toward renewables, and many of them are following that. I mean, companies like Walmart, which is surprising to me. They're installing all LED lights. They're making sure their coolers are as efficient as they can. The buildings are built more greenly than they used to be. I mean, they still don't have a great record, but it's so much better than it was just 20 years ago. There are many other companies that are doing the same thing, and they're listening to reinsurers like Lloyd's of London who tell them, look, this is happening. This is coming. You have to get ready for it. What can you do to lower your emissions and to prepare for what is coming? So if the businesses are doing that, how does this register with voters when Trump says it's bad for business?
Well, this is a challenge because I think a lot of people who are listening to Trump's statements who are on his side on this issue, I don't think are thinking as deeply as many of us are about the implications of his decision for business. You mentioned Walmart. You could look in Michigan at Consumers Energy. DTE is cutting its coal plants out. You can look at the large shareholder vote yesterday at ExxonMobil, a really surprising vote where 63% of their shareholders have asked ExxonMobil to be more transparent and critical about the implications of climate change for their business. So I don't see this affecting business in a positive way at all. To me, this is akin to taking us back in time to the era of incandescent bulbs and coal production. Coal isn't coming back because it doesn't make economic sense. A lot of the innovations on energy efficiency are where new jobs are going to be in the future. So this, to me, is another one of those cases where the rhetoric doesn't match the reality.
So this process is going to take a while. We're not out of the agreement right away. By the way, 195 countries signed on to the Paris Accord. It was amazing. And we are one of three countries not in the agreement now once we withdraw. Us, Syria,
Nicaragua.
And Nicaragua.
Yes, sir.
Good company. So tell me, practically speaking, nothing really changes, does it? I mean, we're not out for a while. He has said the clean power plant rule that Obama was pursuing is not going to be pursued. But, you know, those companies are already, as you mentioned, DTEs, they're already on their way to doing that. So is this going to make any difference, really?
You know, I think from a pragmatic perspective, there's a tremendous amount of momentum toward staying the course on sustainability and climate change. So from a business perspective, as you mentioned, companies like stability. They like to know what's around the corner. They've invested heavily in this already. So I think we'll be staying the course there. Other countries are doing the same thing. If you look at Scandinavian countries, if you look at what's happening across Europe, if you look at what's happening in a place like India where they're doubling down on solar. And the big one here, the world's largest emitter in China, I think they're staying the course in terms of leadership on climate. So from a pragmatic perspective, I think that not a lot will change. However, this is traditional ground for the United States to lead. So I think that every move that Trump makes like this, whether it's around Paris climate, whether it's around the Green Power Plan, whether it's around some of his other statements about the economy, his statements about security, each one of them that's poorly thought out, I think, sets us back in terms of our position on the world stage as a leader. People are already now talking about Angela Merkel as being the leader of the free world. People are talking about the Chinese government as really leading on sustainability and climate. These are radical shifts for the United States. And fundamentally, I think they're going to affect our reputation. And when they affect our reputation, they're going to affect the economy. So I think bad decision making all around.
President Trump has said that he thinks climate change is a hoax. We've seen conservative Republicans change their statements about climate change because they all used to say it's a hoax, it's not happening. We can all remember when Inhofe threw the snowball in the chamber. The Republican congressman from the 7th District in Michigan, Tim Walberg, just was making a statement in Coldwater recently, and he's now saying, I believe there's climate change. I believe there's been climate change since the beginning of time. You know, you can't really argue with that. Do I think man has some impact? Well, yeah, of course. Can man change the entire universe? No. Why do I believe that? He said, well, as a Christian, I believe there is a creator and God who is much bigger than us, and I'm confident if there's a real problem, he can take care of it. So should we just let go and let God, as far as climate change is concerned? Is that the new policy?
Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh. Oh, no, I don't think so. I think regardless of your faith or for those who are non-believers, I don't think that our place on this planet and in this universe is to just sort of throw up our hands and que sera, sera, what will happen will happen. I think that, you know, we have a responsibility to the present. We have a responsibility to future generations. So I think that all of us, if we're going to adopt this rhetoric of fighting, which Donald Trump adopted in his remarks about the Paris Climate Accord, if we're going to walk our talk there, I think we owe it to ourselves and to our children to take a stand on issues, especially issues like climate change. You know, it's heartening to hear Republicans and Democrats talking more honestly about climate change. I'm not sure if those comments are exactly the best example, but there are a lot of Republicans who are talking about climate change now in much more honest terms than they have in the past. I think that makes sense for them. You pointed out a minute ago that it's going to take a while to get out of the Paris Climate Agreement. In fact, the day that the United States could actually get out of the Paris Climate Agreement, at least on paper, is the day after Election Day in 2020. So maybe this is what puts climate change on the map as a major electoral issue in 2018, but also in 2020, where I think it actually belongs. Listen, I think that when it comes to issues like climate change, there are going to be tough trade-offs. Yes, people will lose their jobs. I'm not going to say that they're not going to. This is not unlike a lot of industrial transitions where as new innovations were introduced, the labor market and the market itself had to adjust. That's going to happen here. I think that we should be concerned about and our hearts should go out to people who may lose their jobs as a result of innovation in the name of sustainability and, in this case, climate change. And we should do everything that we can to make sure that those people land on solid footing. But we need to look out for their kids. It's their kids that are going to feel it the most.
But this is a sign of an innovative economy when you do that. I mean, we don't have whale oil anymore. We don't use kerosene to light our house anymore. Those are things that, you know, are natural progression of an active and innovative economy. So it is painful. I understand that. I understand it's painful for the children after. But this has happened before. It's going to happen again. And I don't see how withdrawing from a worldwide agreement that took 10 years to put together is actually going to help us in the long run. And clinging on to coal mines, as President said, going to an opening in Pennsylvania and lots more are going to open. I just don't see how that's the future of the United States.
I don't see that as the future either, and I think that most people who understand these issues from a systems perspective don't see it that way either. I think that, you know, if we're really going to put our money where our mouths are in terms of the economy, putting aside climate change for a second, it's going to be in those areas where, as you said, transitions are taking place. The biggest emissions come from transportation. They come from energy production. They come from industry and manufacturing. All three of those sectors of the economy are greening. All three of those sectors of the economy are trying to reduce their emissions, in part because they were asked to under the last administration, but in part because their customers and their shareholders are demanding it. That's what's going to drive innovation. That's what's going to lead us forward. And I think today, as you pointed out at the outset, was for politics and for show.
Joe Arvai is the Max McGraw Professor of Sustainable Enterprise at the University of Michigan. Thanks for coming in and talking about the withdrawal of the Paris Climate Accord.
It's my pleasure. It's always nice to be here. Thanks, Lester.
Coming up, we'll talk about the future of Belle Isle's Grand Prix race.
The contract allows 11 weeks for race organizers to set up and break down, which is the longest construction period for any street race in the world.
That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. The Mackinac Policy Conference wrapped up today. Our It's Just Politics team of Rick Pluta and Zoe Clark have been covering it. Earlier in the program, we talked with Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly about his Clean Michigan Government Plan, but that was not what most people expected his announcement to be this week. Is he teasing us?
Yes.
Well, and this really was sort of the beginning conversation up here on the island. You know, there's the pillars of what folks are meant to be talking about, but then there's actually the real conversation, the real gossip that's happening on the horse carriages, which maybe you can hear behind us, and folks sitting on the grand porch and talking about things and the gossip. And one of them was a lot of folks expected in April when this announcement that Kelly said, you know, count down to May 30th, that the announcement would be for governor. And instead, on Tuesday this week, he made an announcement about better government.
But let's be clear that this is part of a campaign for governor, that Brian Kelly is looking for really a game changer. Lieutenant governors do not have a history of winning the top job, certainly not here in Michigan. And so, you know, you'll see that the ads on this part-time legislature issue and on this clean government stuff, they feature Brian Kelly talking about it, that this is supposed to boost his recognition and establish a persona in the public mind about him as he gets ready for what's expected to be a pretty fierce contest for the Republican nomination against, among others, State Attorney Bill Schuette, who has also endorsed a government reform platform.
We've seen a lot of videos from Kelly. Everybody was assuming that that was part of the lead-up. We did have a Republican announce he's running for governor this week. Patrick Kolbeck, who's currently a state senator. We're still waiting for the decision about running from Attorney General Bill Schuette. How crowded are we expecting the Republican race for the nomination to get?
I mean, there are a few people who've already declared their lesser-known names. Patrick Kolbeck will try to seize the right side of the field, which is a good place to be in a Republican primary. But we'll see. You know, I mean, a lot of this is getting out, meeting people, but a lot of it is also, by the time the primary rolls around 15 months from now, spending money on television advertising and things like that. And so right now we're really in the preparation stage, the building a campaign organization, setting up your fundraising apparatus, things like that. But make no mistake, Bill Schuette and Brian Kelly are running for governor.
And there's just so much energy with those two candidates within, you know, the sort of Republican establishment that I think when you've got names like that, the joke being that, you know, Bill Schuette has been running for governor since the third grade, that when you have names like that, it really kind of pushes out folks who, you know, may be thinking about it. And that's different than, say, on the Senate race side. There will be a race against Democratic senior senator of Michigan, Debbie Stabenow. And so there are a lot of Republicans looking at that race right now. And that's more of sort of the open, you know, who wants to jump in and go against a really formidable incumbent like Debbie Stabenow.
Let's go to the Democrats who are thinking about governor. Among the Democrats running, the big news this week is Gretchen Whitmer raising a record-setting $1 million this early. What's that mean for Abdul Asayed, who's also announced, and whether Mark Bernstein throws his hat in the ring?
Indeed, it was record-setting $1 million just, you know, for a primary, which I think it just, you know, shows you what a big deal money plays in campaigns like this. I don't think, though, $1 million is going to be the decision for Mark Bernstein about whether or not he jumps in or stays out of the race.
Yeah, he'll be able to raise that pretty quickly if and when it comes to that.
But Mark Bernstein, you know, from the Bernstein Law family name, can definitely raise money and use his own family's money for a race. So for a candidate like that, $1 million doesn't shut him out. But for other candidates, possibly, that is a big number.
And we'll see if Abdul El-Sayed can get the sort of institutional support that would help make up for that.
Although he raised a pretty penny for sort of someone who's come from, I don't want to say behind, but really someone who hasn't been in state government, worked in Lansing before, to raise the amount of money that he has, that's impressive too.
Any news at the Mackinac Policy Conference about the threat of delaying the completion of the state budget because of this fight over legislation that would close the pension option for new public school employees and instead offer a 401k type plan? I mean, the Republicans run the whole show in Lansing, and they're so divided they'll not pass a budget on time?
Yeah, there's still not an agreement on it. Governor Snyder tried to put a compromise on the table, but Arlen Meekhoff, the Senate Majority Leader, Tom Leonard, the House Speaker, they say that they're still sticking by their belief that this should be a completely 401k style system. Although that has a lot of people scratching their heads that, like, this is the do or die controversy, you know, right now on this island and in Lansing. And the governor says that, you know, that there are a lot of institutions that have grown used to having the budget done by the time their fiscal years begin on July 1st. Universities, community colleges, local governments, school districts. And so this is kind of important to them. And, you know, they can't wait till the end of the month because you've still got to implement the budget, you know, get it filed and you know, get the word out on what everyone has. But, you know, right now there's just a lot of saber rattling on that early June deadline.
But it is, I mean, exactly right, this sort of intra-party fight, right? You have Republicans in control of everything in Lansing. And the idea, you know, as Snyder says, he's been 4 out of 4 on getting budgets done on this, you know, June 1st deadline that he's self-imposed deadline, you know, then 5 out of 5 budget, 6 out of 6. And now the fact that, you know, Republican legislators may be holding that sort of, you know, golden apple hostage from him is just sort of awe-inspiring to watch. But, you know, this is the Detroit Regional Chambers Conference. So that, you know, a conversation in the background, because, of course, the state budget will matter to businesses. But a lot of the conversation here, you know, about Detroit, about the Detroit mayoral race coming up in November, you've got Mike Duggan running for re-election and sort of the great, you know, comeback of Detroit. And yet, you know, now we've got Lansing economic issues, you know, front and center. It's a really interesting dynamic.
And you know, Rick Snyder really is of this group, and they're proud of this, that we've got a CEO governor, someone who's one of them and who pays attention to things like getting budgets done on time and balanced.
That's Michigan Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta and our resident political junkie Zoe Clark, the co-host of It's Just Politics. Hey, you two, watch where you step when you head back on the ferry to leave Mackinac Island.
Stepping very carefully.
Thanks, Lester.
Here at Stateside, we like to hear from you. What stories are getting your attention? What issues do you want to hear more about? We'd like to know. Find us on Facebook. Search for Michigan Radio. We're also on Twitter at Stateside Radio and at MichiganRadio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. Hey, Tom.
Yeah, hey, how you doing?
Just fine. Tom Perkins, he's a reporter at Detroit Metro Times. You wrote a piece I found really interesting, and I wonder if you'd tell these folks about the butterfly show and indigenous bird release.
Right. Well, you know, gearheads are upset again. They're protesting outside the Michigan International Speedway because naturists are setting up for the annual Michigan International Speedway butterfly show and indigenous bird release. It takes them about 3 months to set up for it. They have to lay a bunch of sod over the racetrack and plant a bunch of trees in the infield, and they even have a permanent protected wetland and in the middle of the track, but all that leads up to the release of the colorful butterflies and the wonderful native birds. And I'll tell you what, it's a joyous event filled with laughter and love, but gearheads, they don't feel any joy over it, and they're protesting it. They say it's disrespectful to car culture and that the racetrack just shouldn't be used to the butterfly sanctuary and for a bird release.
That might be one of the best setups I have read for a story, a serious story, in a long time. You know, instead of naturists taking over the Michigan International Speedway, we're really talking about a speedway taking over a natural area. And in this case, we're talking about Belle Isle, the 102nd State Park of Michigan and a jewel of Detroit. So there's always been this controversy of Belle Isle's Grand Prix race, but the opposition seems to be escalating. What's happening there?
Yeah, the debate is really intensifying between what I call park goers and gearheads over whether the island should be used strictly as a public park to host the Grand Prix, which runs each June, but requires about 3 months of setup and breakdown. So at the moment, the Michigan Department of Natural Resources, which manages the island, is in the process of developing its long-term plan for for the island, but at the same time, the contract that the city of Detroit signed with race organizer Roger Penske, that contract is about to expire, so it's up for renegotiation, and I believe in 2018, and the discussions over a new contract are already underway.
I want to get into all that, but let's for people who aren't familiar with what's going on here, you know, we're talking about concrete barricades, we're talking about putting up long bleachers and all kinds of facilities, and it takes a really long time. Why does it take so long?
You know, that's a pretty good question. The contract allows 11 weeks for race organizers to set up and break down, which is the longest construction period for any street race in the world. I called around and checked with other race organizers and other reporters who covered different races. And, you know, for example, in Toronto, the IndyCar race there is up and down within 3 weeks, and there are no street closures except for race weekends. So we haven't really gotten any good explanation as to why it takes the 3 months in Detroit. Race organizers have said it's a safety issue, but there's no evidence to show that the Belle Isle Grand Prix is any safer or any more organized than other races. And in fact, you've had incidents here with the track falling apart and a fireman getting hit by a car. So what's probably the issue is money. It costs less to take 11 weeks, 12 weeks to set it up than to do it in 3 weeks.
So Detroit's the Motor City. A lot of people think it's kind of fitting to have a major race in Detroit. Draws 60,000, 65,000 spectators. Roger Penske, the organizer, pays a fair amount of money to hold the Grand Prix on Belle Island, and some of the proceeds go to the Belle Isle Conservancy. So everybody wins, right?
Well, you have to sacrifice a lot of the park's assets to get all that money, you know, and I tell people that you really have to go out there in April, May, or June and see the construction project to appreciate its scale. I mean, you'll find the entire west end of the island filled with concrete barriers, cables, cell phone towers, porta-johns, shipping containers, trucks, miles and miles of fencing, concrete barriers. Next to the Scott Memorial Fountain, the Penske's team laid a 400,000-square-foot concrete paddock that's there permanently. And then the worst part about it, what I feel like people feel is the worst part of it, are the traffic jams. If you try to get on the island anytime around race weekend, it's, you know, you can wait an hour-long traffic jams just to get onto the island. And then, you know, you're kind of in a compacted area because the entire West End is filled with the racetrack.
You talk to a lot of people out at the park, people who use it regularly. What do they think of it?
You know, I did sort of an informal poll where I talked to, or in which I talked to 50 different people about some of the issues like the traffic jams, the construction timelines. You know, nobody's ever really asked regular park users how they feel about those issues. And what I found was that people are overwhelmingly upset about them. Nobody wants to wait an hour to get onto Belle Isle. Nobody thinks it's reasonable that the western half of the island is restricted or filled up with the construction project for 3 months out of the year. So, you know, while there might be a little bit of support for the idea of holding the Grand Prix on Belle Isle, actually doing so, actually holding it there, it's a lot more complicated than it might seem on the face of it.
If the Belle Isle Grand Prix organizers could cut the time it takes to construct the racetrack, how far would that go in making the regular visitors to the park okay with the event?
Some people want it off the island altogether. Some people don't think there should be an auto race in Detroit, period. And then some people say that they'd be okay with a race in which the setup and breakdown took 3 weeks, like you see in Toronto or other major cities around the world. So, I mean, I think that would help a lot. Some people still wouldn't be happy.
What kind of money are we talking about here? How much does Belle Isle and the Conservancy get because of a Grand Prix?
The Grand Premier charity event raised $1.1 million a couple of years ago, and then it's been more around $500,000 the last couple of years. But as a couple of people have pointed out, a couple of the race critics have pointed out, you know, that's really not that much money when you start to look at what's out there via some of these foundations and charitable organizations and philanthropists, you can find people who will support Belle Isle's mission and not ask for use of half the island for an auto race for half the warm season.
So you mentioned the DNR and a contract with the Grand Prix folks that's it's expiring and they have to renegotiate it. Any hint whether DNR is taking the length of time it takes to set up or whether they're really on board with having Grand Prix there at all?
From my conversation with Ron Olson, the DNR's parks director, it sounds like the race will be back. Somebody said that an island official told the Detroit City Council it'll be there for 9 weeks instead of 11 weeks each year. But Ron says that isn't true. He says that they're still trying to figure it all out. But from the way that he talks, it sounds like the race will be back. I don't know if the construction timeline will be shortened or not.
That's Tom Perkins. He's a reporter at Detroit Metro Times. The title of the article we've been talking about is As Belle Isle's Grand Prix Hits a Crossroads, Gearheads and Parkgoers Tussle for Its Future. Gentlemen, stop your engines. Thanks very much, Tom. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We want to leave you with this. The Detroit Free Press noted it was 50 years ago today that Aretha Franklin's Respect became the number one song on the Billboard Hot 100, her first song to hit number one. Otis Redding first released the song in 1965, but when Aretha did it, she put her indelible stamp on it. She didn't write it, but she owned it. Respect also topped the Billboard R&B rankings and stayed there for a couple of months. She won two Grammys for the recording. It was embraced by both the women's rights movement and the civil rights movement. The Free Press reports Respect will be on the set list on June 10th when Aretha Franklin plays a free outdoor show at Detroit Music Weekend in Detroit's Theater District. Looking back, she says it was a natural. Quote, we all want respect and should get it. She's earned it more than just a little bit. I'm Lester Graham. Have a great weekend.